Your Honor, I am aware that that has been done. I don't think it's been
done. Mr. Taggart represented to us that the Court of Criminal Appeals said we will not retreat from this. I wasn't sure if that was pre-Penry or post-Penry.
Well, Your Honor, what I'm not saying is not that the Court of Criminal Appeals has required it, but I know in at least some cases, and I don't want to misspeak, I know it's a very small number, the trial court gave those instructions when requested, even though there was no state appellate authority for doing so.
What is the date of the new statute?
It became effective September 1st of 1991. Although Graham concedes, as he must, that Jurek remains good law.
Can I ask on the timing issue? Your opponent cited Black against State, which I haven't read. What is the significance of that case in this time sequence? The 1991 case, I think.
Your Honor, I'm not sure I know if it's the case. I think it is. It had to do with excusing a defendant's failure to raise the issue at trial. In other words, excusing a procedural default. But I will defer to what Mr. Tiger tells you in that regard. As I was saying, Graham concedes, as he must, that Jurek remains good law. Yet, he asked this court to interpret Penry in a manner that can't be squared with Jurek. As the Court of Appeals observed, Graham's interpretation of Penry is so broad that it requires that Jurek be overruled. Viewed in that light, his claim has failed because it is a new rule that will be barred by Teague versus Lane. Or, in the alternative, if Penry is to be interpreted as Graham urges, that is, to abrogate Jurek, then Penry was wrongly decided and should be overruled. The court need not go that far, however, but can decide this case simply by doing as the Fifth Circuit did, attempting to reconcile the two lines of capital sentencing precedent, and by clarifying the holding of Penry. As the court has noted many times in explaining the operations of the Texas statute and in reconfirming the validity of Jurek, Texas narrows the class of death eligibles at the guilt phase through the statutory elements of capital murder.
But I take it your position is that youth is not a mitigating factor in the sense that it reduces the culpability of the offender for having committed the offense.
No, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor, that is what I'm saying.
Yes, if culpability for the crime that's been committed were a mitigating factor, the second question the jury has to answer does not reflect that.
Well,
it goes only to future dangerousness.
Yes, Your Honor, but what the point I'm making is that his present culpability, his culpability for the crime itself, is taken into account by the jury at two different stages of the trial. One, in finding him guilty of the capital murder itself, because in doing so, it is found him to be eligible for the death penalty. And then the second time, through the first special issue, on whether or not he committed the crime deliberately.
Well, deliberately just means intentionally?
No, Your Honor. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has said that deliberately is not the linguistic equivalent of intentionally. Deliberately is a state of mind that embraces more than a will to engage in the conduct. It is the mental process that activates the intentional act.
Well, to the extent that it is claimed that a youth as compared with an adult is really not in full control of himself, that may be considered under Issue 1.
Yes, Your Honor, and it's also something that necessarily can be considered under Issue 2 because the jury knows and is told, as it was by Graham's counsel at his trial, that he will not remain a youth forever. He will change, he will slow down.
I understand that, but that has to do with the future.
Yes, Your Honor, that does.
And how does youth enter into the determination of guilt initially? It's in this same way to find that the requisite intent existed? That's duplicative.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure.
I thought you indicated that youth is taken into account in deciding whether he's guilty to begin with, guilty of the murder.
If that was how Your Honor understood me, I apologize. What I was saying was that his present culpability is determined at the guilt stage, and Under the statute, of course, youth is not a legal excuse for committing a capital murder, but it is something that can be and has been argued on the first special issue, that is the deliberateness issue.
You're back just to the special issues. You indicated that Penry should or could be clarified. Do you have a suggestion or formulation to clarify Penry?
Your Honor, we would urge that to what the Court of Appeals did in this case is a noble attempt to reconcile the court's two lines of cases. I really can add nothing beyond that.
Do you think the Court of Appeals dealt with youth in terms of culpability at all? I thought it just said as long as youth could be considered a factor in future dangerousness, which it can, that was as far as...
No, Your Honor, I believe what the Court of Appeals said is that the special issues allow, the special issues, particularly the future dangerousness issue, allow the jury to consider youth as a mitigating factor. And it is our position that the first special issue does so also.
Did the Court of Appeals expressly deal with the notion of youth as a mitigating factor in the sense of less culpability for committing the crime that he's committed? Did the Court of Appeals talk about that? Other than by saying you don't need a special instruction on that?
I'm not sure they addressed it in just the terms Your Honor has posed. What they did say, and what I would argue strenuously to the court, is that there is no showing that youth is mitigating other than the purpose for which it was offered at trial, and that was with regard to the future dangerousness issue. Mm-hmm. And in that regard, we'd rely on Boyd, where the court observed that the mitigating value of evidence can be determined from the purpose for which...
But opinions of this court, perhaps some that I haven't joined, really refer to culpability, don't they?
They do, Your Honor. And again, it is our position that...
There's plenty of support in the cases that youth is a factor that is fairly considered in terms of culpability.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't wish to beat this too much, but again, the first issue focuses on present culpability, the second on future dangerousness.
Mr. Palmer, I'm not sure I understand how youth is considered under the first question. As a premise to asking you about that, may I just ask you to go back a moment to something that I think I recall you were saying when you were commenting on the manner in which the Texas courts have defined deliberateness, and you said they didn't simply equate it with intention. If I remember what you said correctly, you said that they had defined deliberateness or deliberation as the process which leads to the doing of an intentional act. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right. Well, does it follow from that whenever an intentional act has been committed, that it must therefore have been a deliberate act or the result of deliberation?
No, Your Honor. The way...
Then I don't think I understand you.
Well, Your Honor, quite frankly, I'm not sure I understand all these nuances of mens rea myself. But as I understand it, what the Court of Criminal Appeals has held is deliberateness falls somewhere between premeditation and intent. And it involves some mental process more than simply the intent to do the act, but less than deliberated premeditation.
So it isn't merely an element leading to an intentional act. It is, in some sense, a further mental element in addition to intentionality.
Exactly, Your Honor.
It has been so defined by the Texas courts.
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but could you give me a cite to a case?
Yes, Your Honor.
So construed it.
I would cite Deference versus State. It's a 1981 case. 620 Southwest 2nd, 577.
I'm sorry,
620, Your Honor, 577.
Southwestern?
2nd.
Yeah.
Now, with that as a premise, would you explain to me how youth comes into the the consideration of deliberateness? Is it in the sense that a young person is thought to be less capable of engaging in this kind of deliberative process? Is that the point?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that much can be gleaned from Graham's brief in this case, where he lists the qualities of youth that are deemed to be mitigating, and among them is impulsiveness, the inability to think rationally or maturely before acting. Obviously, deliberate is going to be the converse of impulsive, and if a quality of youth is impulsiveness, then just as obviously the deliberateness inquiry will encompass that. As I was saying moments ago, the class is narrowed at the guilt phase. Then we have the punishment phase, at which the state bears the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt on all of the special issues. We know from Walton v. Arizona that it is permissible for the defendant to prove mitigation by preponderance. Texas affords the defendants, its capital defendants, much more protection in that regard by requiring the state to prove the issues beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant is allowed to introduce whatever evidence he wishes in mitigation, and the jury normally is instructed, as it was in Graham's case at page 10 of the joint appendix, that it is to consider all the evidence presented. Not only is there no instruction limiting the jury's consideration of that evidence, but is in fact instructed to consider all the evidence introduced at both phases of trial. Henry simply held, we believe, that supplemental instructions were required in that case to allow the jury to give effect to his mental retardation and childhood abuse as mitigating factors. And that holding followed from the recognition that although Henry's evidence had mitigating quality, that it was essentially aggravating as to the future dangerousness inquiry.
Wasn't it also true that there was some emphasis in the opinion on the lesser moral culpability for a mentally retarded person?
That is true, Your Honor. And I suppose to that extent, Henry's evidence cannot be considered within the first special issue either.
To that extent,
what? I'm having trouble hearing
that. That the jury was not able to give full mitigating effect to his evidence within the first special issue as well as the second.
But to that extent, isn't the case somewhat similar, at least to this case, in that, at least under Justice White's questioning, it suggested that youth may reduce the moral culpability of the defendant. But you take the position it does not reduce the moral culpability of the defendant. The chronological age does not, but mental age might.
No, Your Honor. We will accept that perhaps chronological age does, but that it has no relevance outside the inquiries posed by the two special issues, the first two.
The reduced moral culpability of the defendant has no relevance?
No, Your Honor, we accept that that's relevant, and that is a consideration as far as mitigating evidence goes. It's simply our position that the special issues allow consideration of that with regard to whether he acted deliberately and then as to future actions through the second issue.
That the special issues do allow adequate consideration of reduced moral culpability.
Then. Yes, Your Honor.
But then why wasn't that a satisfactory answer in Penry? That's what I'm not clear on.
Well, again, I would defer to what the Court of Appeals said, and that is that Penry suffered from a uniquely severe permanent handicap. That is the standard that this circuit has enunciated that a capital defendant must satisfy to prevail on a Penry claim. And
I see the relevance of that when you're predicting future dangerousness, but I'm not quite sure I understand why that serves to distinguish the two cases on moral culpability.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I can't give you any other answer than I have.
Suppose 10 years goes by so that a 17-year-old is not sentenced until he's 27 years old. Does future dangerousness then take into account his youth at the time of the commission of the crime?
I would say not, Your Honor.
It was 4 years in this case until he was sentenced?
No, Your Honor. He was tried and sentenced 5 months after the
offense. 5 months.
Now, again, my primary position, and forgive me for articulating so poorly, is that it's the first special issue that focuses on the present culpability. But the second special issue allows the jury to give mitigating effect to his youth as having the capacity for rehabilitation, the capacity for rehabilitation being an equally valid sentencing concern as his personal culpability. Graham also argues that the prosecutor argued his youth as a basis for a sentence of death. The record does not support this assertion. The argument, which is contained at page 480 of the joint appendix, simply stressed that Graham was a demonstrably violent person and that his past actions were probative of his future behavior. The prosecutor did not argue that, even remotely suggest, that Graham deserved to die because he was young. Finally, Your Honors, in closing, I would like to respond to what I consider a rather curious assertion that the act of the Texas legislature in amending the statute somehow lends validity to Graham's claim. As an initial matter, I would note that it is incorrect, as Graham asserts at footnote 11 of his reply brief, that the Office of the Attorney General crafted and sponsored the new statute. In fact, the statute that was passed is not the one that was drafted and supported by our office. That matter aside, it can hardly be doubted the legislature acted prudently in responding to the Penry Court's concerns. And in amending the statute, they necessarily did so broadly enough to encompass the class of Penry excludables. Their action in doing so, however, should not be taken as a concession as to the validity of the 360 remaining convictions. I think this assertion is perhaps supported by the fact that there have been 21 executions that have taken place since Penry, all under the old statute. In closing, Your Honors, I would like to emphasize that the scope of the decision in this case far exceeds mere youth. We are seeing since Penry was decided, we've seen a number of claims by capital defendants as to what constitutes mitigating evidence. And included in those are the fact that the defendant was a sociopath, a condition this court has found very aggravating in Smith versus Estelle.
That's claimed to be mitigating, the fact the person's a sociopath?
Yes, Your Honor. James Demasheff, the last prisoner to be executed in Texas, the execution of which took place last month, that was precisely his submission, that he was a sociopath, that explained his actions, that he could not control it, and that therefore it was mitigating under the rule of Penry. We've also been told things such as by a Hispanic petitioner who claimed that it was part of Hispanic culture to smoke marijuana and to get into fights, and that the evidence he presented of that at his trial was mitigating. We've seen claims from defendants who were brought up, they claim, to hate a particular racial group, and therefore the acts of violence they committed on members of that group were mitigating. Again, these claims, bizarre as they may seem, fit within the language of Penry in that they explain the defendant's actions and they show that he is burdened with a condition over which he has no control. If the court has no further questions, that concludes my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Mr. Tiger, you have 9 minutes.
We have a watershed difference here about what the jury was told in this case as to special issue number one and the intent element of the offense, and something of a difference about Texas law. I'd like to try to resolve it. At pages 6 and 7 of our brief, quoting from the joint appendix, we have extensive quotations from the voir dire as to what the jurors were told. Deliberately means that, in my mind anyway, it is a person's intention to do something, and other remarks to the same effect. At Joint Appendix 5, we have the jury instructions given in the guilt phase. Intentionally, or with intent with respect to the nature of his conduct, or to a result of his conduct, when it is his conscious objective or desire to engage in the conduct or cause the result. Now, all that complicated language does is read out Section 6.02A of the Texas Penal Code, which differs from the model penal code quadripartite intent elements only in that Texas chooses to use the word intention rather than purposefulness, which is the more preferred model penal code formulation. But then when it's defined, it's the same thing. It's in terms of this conscious objective or desire. So there can't be any doubt that the trial judge conflated these two standards and thus took care of any mitigating force that might have been in special issue number one.
Well,
Is the jury entitled to consider the strength of the state's evidence on intent?
The standard of proof, Justice Kennedy, is the same with respect to both of the elements, so that there really isn't any opportunity for the jury to do other than look again to the same things they looked at, plus, of course, the additional aggravating evidence when they get on to the punishment phase. That's the difficulty. Now, then we look at Black versus State. Now, that's a post-Penry decision. And there's a defendant up in the...
Mr. Tiger, your argument that you just made, that in this case the judge conflated this and that, I suppose that doesn't go to the... to the facial validity of the Texas statute.
No, it doesn't, Justice White.
And so you might win this case, but if the trial judge had spoken differently, you might lose it.
That's correct, Justice White, and we might have lost this case if the defendant were 25 years old. If the case were a different one than it was, at the margin as opposed to right in the center, then there'd be a different result. That's the meaning of an as-applied challenge. And if I may interrupt my Black versus State discussion, that's what we think is wrong with the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals turns Penry on its head because it doesn't look at this question of youth in its relationship to the very thing that the court identified in Eddings as central. Instead, it goes off on this future dangerousness thing and analyzes it in that regard and then gets to the result that it gets to.
Mr. Tiger, your opponent says that claims have been raised in Texas now since Penry that being a sociopath is in effect a mitigating circumstance. If you prevail here, do you think that would have to be regarded as a mitigating evidence?
Of course not, Justice Rehnquist. Of course not. I mean, this court said in Eddings how this is to be done. There are these constitutionally mitigating factors, and then there's an assessment of the evidence standard. The opinion for the court in Boyd versus California should teach anyone foolhardy enough to come up here what's going to happen to them if they make an argument of that kind. So I don't think that the court needs to worry about that. The problem is that, the Court of Criminal Appeals will decide those cases, and presumably the court won't want to hear them. The problem with the Court of Criminal Appeals in this Black case is that at page 364 they say, unless your name is Penry and you took the same IQ test, what they say, we will not retreat, means no additional jury instructions. It's futile to ask for them. No procedural bar.
Well, it could be that mental retardation is such a... so likely in every case to affect somebody's control, that you just have a per se rule about it, that you have to have a separate instruction. But just being youthful, maybe it ought to be decided on a case-to-case basis, which arguably, at least Texas argues, is amply taken care of in issue one.
It could be, perhaps, Justice White. That was the promise of Jurek.
In some other case.
Well, they promised in Jurek they were going to do it, and then they didn't. And that, it seems to me, is the difference between the facial and as-applied challenge. To look at it more broadly, in Stanford versus Kentucky, the court wrote an opinion. You counted the statutes. You looked at the 29 states that said, let's put youth in there. 29 is surely more of a constitutional consensus than that found inadequate in Stanford, and yet not quite so much as the one you had in Coker. So I think that it's a fair question whether you have to say youth or whether under one of these catch-all statutes it would be adequate to those purposes. And the final observation I would make is that we are told that mitigating evidence didn't take up very many pages in the transcript. The Fifth Circuit accepted it for what it was, so that issue has been resolved. The hearsay point... I wonder where trial counsel for the state was or for the district attorney. It wasn't objected to. The point about youth is that it only takes a word in the transcript. He's 17. And the evocative power of it in our law life for 2,200 years of recorded legal history has been enough for sentencers to say, oh, he is? That's mitigating. And that, if the court please, is our respectful submission.
Thank you, Mr. Tiger. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until Monday next at 10 o'clock.